The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, December 26, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, it is the first of our best of cavalcade of 2016. We're all on vacation right now. I am probably still drunk as I am with my in-laws. And this is, trust me, the best way for me to be. Although it's arguable as to whether or not mixing Xanax. I've never had Xanax, but I've been told this would really knock me out. And that's probably best case scenario for everyone around me. I've now probably watched like 35 episodes of Paw Patrol and had eggnog, and I can only imagine. I think there's been some Trump voters around here, and I have a feeling Mila is not appreciating that. So, I mean, who knows what's going on? But for you folks, for you good folks, I hope you had a Merry Christmas, and I hope you're enjoying your ongoing Hanukkah celebrations, as well as Kwanzaa. But to help you with that celebration, we have some best ofs that Matt has assembled from the year. Of course, enjoying those celebrations, what could be better than hearing about white rage, the unspoken truth of our racial divide? Written by Carol Anderson. This is an interview that we did sometime in 2016. We're in post details. We're in a post details world.
Post fact check world.
Post fact check world. But it was definitely 2016. Trust me on this, folks.
And it was great.
It was great. It was a great interview, and I think you will enjoy it. So here's how it's going to work with these shows. You're getting a best of every day of the week. I know, it's crazy. I don't know why we're doing this for you, but we are. Consider it our end of year a gift to you. So Carol Anderson today, and Matt is going to sprinkle throughout the week funny clips that are still hopefully arguably funny, despite the fact that the candidate that we were convinced would not win actually won. So we're going to lay off probably... Probably Matt has better taste than to include some mocking of Donald Trump, just because we don't want our internet to be pulled during the thing. But of course, he's not president. Yeah, he can't quite do that.
Yeah, we have another couple of weeks before we have to really, I think, frankly, talk about his incredible business career, his beautiful family.
Now, we do have a membership half of the program, which we call the fun half. And today, in the fun half, you will hear a deep archive program, an interview that we did on the deep, like Majority Report from back in the aughts, ladies and gentlemen, with, as part of the fun half, you'll hear Jared Diamond on his book, Collapse.
As you can see.
Matt has a thematic understanding of this week. This week's offerings are going to be, you know.
What we're trying to say is that the Mayans were right. They're just a couple years off.
All right. So enjoy Carol Anderson on her book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. And also our funny offering. It'll be just a minute or two and maybe only vaguely humorous. And then members will enjoy Jared Diamond from the deep archives of the Majority Report on his book, Collapse. See you tomorrow, and you're going to love tomorrow's show. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Carol Anderson. She's a professor of African American Studies at Emory University and author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Welcome to the program, Carol.
Oh, thank you so much, Sam.
So, I just played a clip of Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark, who was on the Sean Hannity program, talking about the breakdown in Milwaukee, in his words, following a couple of nights of unrest, to say the least. And we should say your book came out of unrest in Ferguson, an op-ed that you wrote almost a year ago to the day about what was happening in Ferguson. I wonder, let's just start with that in Milwaukee, because I imagine it's illustrative in to a large extent of your of the argument you're making in White Rage.
Absolutely. So when you look at Milwaukee, one of the things that first hit me was almost the thing that hit me with Ferguson, is that the image that the media showed were the cars burning and the gas station burning. It's like, oh, my God, riots, riots. And they're showing these flames. And just like with Ferguson, I said, we are paying so much attention to the flames, we're missing the kindling. We're missing the range of policies put in place year after year after year to systematically deny African Americans access to their citizenship rights, and that these policies really come into place and solidify, particularly in these moments where African Americans have gained greater access, where they have achieved greater access to their citizenship rights. And boom, you look at Milwaukee. So for instance, when the Brown decision came down in 1954, we spend a lot of time in American history focusing in on the South and how the South really was like, oh, we're not doing that, absolutely, positively, no way. Well, Milwaukee went, okay, you want us to integrate? This is how we're going to do it. And so because the schools in the black neighborhoods were awful, so they put black children on a bus, bused them to white schools, put them in a self-contained classroom where all they spoke with and dealt with were themselves, and then put them back on a bus. It was almost like a quarantining them from movement to, you know, from place to place. This was Milwaukee. So the policies in Milwaukee are the root of what we're seeing. And the citizens in Milwaukee, the black citizens there, have made that very clear.
And we should say I think it's the most segregated city in the country. Is that right?
Yes, that's what I saw. And where you also have almost a 33% poverty rate in the black community, where that has been exacerbated by Governor Scott Walker's policies to reduce access to public transportation for those who live in the city so that they could get to where the jobs are growing out in the suburbs. Mm. So you create a policy that says, hey, you're impoverished, but we're going to make it so that you can be even more impoverished because you can't get to the job. And so you might say, well, what about driving? The way that they've written the laws there in Milwaukee is that about half of all African Americans or African American males, I can't remember which, do have a suspended driver's license. And that suspension carries up to a 2-year term, which is longer than you can get for DUI. Wow. So if you've got half of the driver's license suspended, and that's for things like not paying a fine, and we know about what hyper policing does in the black community, just the way that you had in Ferguson and in Baltimore. So it's setting the system up to penalize, to harass, to the point where these rights are stripped by policy, by law.
And we should say, and I think the point of your book, and I think, you know, over the past several years, I feel like I've come to appreciate this more. And on one level, it's sort of obvious, but on another level, it's something that we seem to forget, is that this isn't really about even setting up these systems. I mean, this is the perpetuation of a system, and we're just seeing different tactics, right? I mean, because this goes back. I mean, and let's start with Reconstruction. I mean, obviously, and I think it's, you know, it's self-evident when people are slaves that they're being subjugated. But we see that even after emancipation, the pushback, and this is what you describe throughout the book, is that there is progress and then there is blowback and pushback on it.
Blowback. That was good. Blowback.
Let's start with Reconstruction, because by your estimates, 80% of the country's GDP was a function of slavery in some fashion or another. And that was obviously, I guess, traumatic for the country to lose that. Let's take it from Reconstruction.
Yeah, so here we have this moment where the formerly enslaved are no longer property. By law, they are not property. That was absolutely jarring for so many in the Deep South, as well as for some in the North, but in the South. And what you saw were a series of laws that immediately came into place because President Andrew Johnson provided almost blanket amnesty for all of the Confederate leaders. So the folks who, in fact, attacked the United States in order to maintain slavery were now back in power after the Civil War. They passed what are known as the Black Codes. The Black Codes applied only to black people. The Black Code said that African Americans had to sign a yearly labor contract, and that they couldn't leave to go to another job. They had to stay with that employer, no matter how brutal, no matter how horrific the working conditions, no matter what kinds of wages were being paid. It said that African Americans, if you did not sign a labor contract, you could be arrested and charged with vagrancy. And then a plantation owner or a mill owner could then pay your fine, and you would have to work off your fine by basically indebting your labor to this plantation owner. It denied African Americans the right to own weapons so that they could not hunt or fish. That way, they couldn't stave off starvation, and so they would have to go and work in one of these areas for one of these brutal employers. It was a way to reinscribe slavery.
How did, I mean, you know, I imagine people are asking themselves, like, well, how, I don't understand. How was this legal? How could you pass this laws? Where was the recourse?
And they could pass these laws because Andrew Johnson was a Democrat from Tennessee who believed that this war was only about preserving the Union. It wasn't about slavery. And so the moment that the Union had been preserved, he did not care about 4 million freed people. And as I said, he provided amnesty. Now, Congress is on recess at the time. When Congress comes back, Congress said, "What did you do?" And Johnson said, "I saved this nation." And Congress is like, "That doesn't look like saving," because there's mass killing happening. The legal system provides no shelter for African Americans. They can't testify in court. Again, in the Black Codes, they can't testify against whites. And so you have this massive battle between Congress and the White House on who is going to control Reconstruction. Under Andrew Johnson, not only did you have the sanctioning of the Black Codes, but you also had the stripping of 40 acres and a mule, which was the means to provide some level of economic sustenance sustenance for 4 million freed people. And understand that this isn't land given to the slaves. This is land that is going to be leased to them. Mm. It's not like the Homestead Act that Johnson fought so hard for, which was to give 160 acres to poor whites. But this is where blacks would have to lease 40 acres. He rescinded that and had federal troops remove black people from the land. And this is land that had been abandoned by the plantation owners.
And so, I mean, once we have this sort of round of blowback, right? I mean, you have emancipated slaves, and then almost immediately you start to curtail all of those new freedoms. And
yes.
You do it directly, and you do it through bank shots, right? I mean, the idea that you can't hunt means that your options, I mean, particularly at that time, are extremely limited in terms of the way that you're going to feed yourself and your family.
Exactly.
So where is the next sort of push in terms of progress, and then that is followed by the backlash again?
Yeah, so the next piece that I look at is the Great Migration, because here you have black people basically saying, I am getting ready to take control of my own destiny. I'm leaving the South, and I'm going to go work up north where the wages are a lot better than what I'm dealing with here, where there appears to be a functioning legal system so that I don't have to deal with all of the lynching that is happening.
And we should tell people we're talking now basically from the early 1900s, I mean, I guess theoretically through the mid 20th century, and maybe even when does the Great Migration technically end?
Yes, so you have the first wave of the Great Migration, which is about 1915 to 1940, and then you have the second wave of the Great Migration, which I don't really cover in the book, which goes during the Second World War and takes us up until about the mid-1960s.
Okay.
And again, you have black people pouring out of the South because the jobs are really up north, because better pay is up north. And part of what we understand is that in the United States, you have the right to take your labor elsewhere. You have the right to take your labor to a better employer. What happened during the Great Migration, and this is when the U.S. is in the First World War and fighting to make the world safe for democracy, is that you had governments in the South, like in Jacksonville, Florida, like in Georgia, passing laws banning African Americans from leaving the area to go get a better job. And saying that they will be, if they're found guilty, they will be incarcerated, where they will have to work off their labor. So basically a way to enslave again. And so think about that. You cannot leave Jacksonville, Florida for a better job. Mm. and they banned, you know, we talk about First Amendment rights. They banned the Chicago Defender. Because the Chicago Defender was a massive conduit of information about jobs and housing up north. And so you have municipality after municipality banning a newspaper in order to shut down the flow of information. Now, if that sounds like behind the Iron Curtain, it is. But this is what's happening in America while the U.S. is fighting to make the world safe for democracy. You also have them stopping trains, physically stopping trains.
So they would pull people off of trains, black people off of trains, just to keep them from migrating.
Absolutely, absolutely. And they were charging labor agents who were the labor recruiters from the North. They were charging them licensing fees up to $25,000, and this is in like 1917 dollars. $25,000 for a license to be able to recruit labor, and if they did, if the labor agent didn't pay that fee, then the labor agent could be found guilty and thrown in jail.
So, in the context of the migration, Mm-hmm. Were the impediments to migrating, they seem to be coming both from the point of departure and the point of arrival.
Yes, and that was the problem with the North. The North was no promised land. It was no paradise. The racism had been less obvious, simply because 90% of all black people lived in the South at the time. But what the Great Migration did, 10% of the black population, in fact, moved north. And that is a massive migration. It would change the electoral and demographic map up north. But what they faced were massive housing discrimination, for instance. Like in Detroit, I talk about the case of Dr. Ossian Sweet, who moved to Detroit after getting his medical degree from Howard. But Detroit, although the black population had increased within the span of a few years by 10 times its original number, The area where black people could live did not expand. And so imagine putting 10 times the number of people in the same square miles. And the housing conditions were awful. In that area, known as Black Bottom, by the way, half of the homes had outhouses. Mm. We're thinking of the North, and you've got indoor plumbing. Not in Black Bottom. And so Ossian Sweet was, I work hard. I've got my medical degree. I want to raise my daughter in a decent neighborhood that's not loaded with outhouses and the kind of poverty where landlords, absentee landlords, are charging exorbitant rents for ramshackle housing that they refuse to reinvest in.
So there's obviously, at this time, no real legal recourse because it's difficult to get into the courts. You need lawyers who are willing to take clients who are not going to be able to pay them in many instances. And you need courts that would even be willing to hear these cases to challenge some of the underlying laws that are involved here. How explicit from the point of departure and also the point of arrival were these, how explicit were the motives and the intent expressed? So, I mean,
explicitly.
Okay.
Explicitly. So, in the Ossian Sweet case, for instance, the Michigan Supreme Court, prior to his moving into the Garland Avenue home where the violence would break out, is that the Supreme Court in 1922 in the Parmalee decision said that residential segregation is in fact constitutional, and that it was okay for homeowners associations to do whatever it took to keep their neighborhoods white. You had the rise of these homeowner associations masked in the language of protecting property values, because that's also one of the ways that white rage works. It doesn't just say, we hate black people. It masks a lot of what it does in the language of democracy, in the language of everything that just sounds reasonable. And that's where we get to issues like voter ID, where we are right now.
Well, yeah, I want to move forward because also the in between really that and, what we're talking about with these sort of these basic fundamental rights of housing, I should say, maybe that's going too far in terms of the way we perceive housing in this country, but access to housing. And even in that instance, I mean, for 25 states, if you're gay, you're kept from housing. And certainly, obviously, if you're low income, you're also kept from housing. But let's move forward to the next major, inflection point that you talk about. And that is in the context, yes, Brown v. Board of Education. And or I should say V Board of Education, and sort of everything that has happened in the education sector. I mean, because there is this sense of like, there's two steps, you know, maybe broadly speaking, two steps forward, one step back on some level. And now we've got up to like education.
Right. And so we get to education and education. So we get the Brown decision that says Jim Crow schools, no. And particularly because the states were never able to implement Plessy. Separate, yes, they got, but equal, never. You ran anywhere from 10 times to almost 1,500% differential in funding between white schools and black schools. And so what the states did when Brown came down the pike, and they were prepared for this, they shut down their public schools. They then channeled public dollars, tax dollars, into all-white private academies so that white students could continue their education at all-white schools, all-white private schools, paid with by tax dollars.
So what states did this?
Virginia was notorious, and particularly Prince Edward County. In Prince Edward County, those schools were shut down for 5 years. And so even imagine what you know when you are in the fifth grade and what you know when you're in the 10th. That's what Virginia did to black children. Shut down those schools and made sure that the white children were educated, provided absolutely nothing for black children. Arkansas did the same thing under Governor Faubus. Those schools weren't shut down as long, but and in the process, and what the legislators also said, so for instance, Attorney General Eugene Cook said, you know, we know that the laws that we're putting up, they were putting up so many laws. He said, we know they're unconstitutional and they're going to be knocked down. But every year that we can spend in court dragging this thing out is another year that we don't have to implement Brown.
Mm.
And so the whole point was to just grind this process down and out until we would have such entrenched inequalities in our school systems. And so then I take us up to the 1970s, because we're still having battles over implementing Brown.
Well, before we get there, there's question that I've had that I've tried to do a little research on, and I've yet to find an answer. But it certainly occurs to me that, because it's quite a coincidence, but that the funding our public schools by property taxes seems to me to be a great way of making sure that the right people have good schools and the wrong people don't. And I'm curious if you know when that was implemented, or if that was, you know, when that funding, has it always been such, or did that form of funding public schools begin to get adopted around the time of Brown?
You know, that's a great question, and I'm going to find out. I know that it was clearly implemented by the time we get to the Rodriguez decision, which I'm going to talk about. And I know that in the 50s, there was discussion in Virginia about property taxes. And that led to the language of whites in Virginia talking about using our taxes to pay for their schools, except black people were paying property taxes too. and except their taxes were now then funneled into all white private academies. So that use of property taxes as a funding mechanism for schools, I don't know the answer to that, but I know that it was in full-blown operation by the time we're in the 60s, and I'm sure it was before then as well, because it feels too entrenched with the Rodriguez decision.
I mean, that's, again, another sort of, I mean, I don't know if that's why it was implemented, but it seems like awful coincidental that it has that impact of making sure that poorer communities, which would be disproportionately of color, have less resources to provide for schools.
Absolutely. So the Edgewood district in San Antonio was 96% Mexican American and Black. It had the lowest median income and the lowest property values. So much of that had to do with public policy about zoning laws, what could be put in that neighborhood, what couldn't be put in that neighborhood. And we know this is like where we decide to put landfills and where we don't. They taxed themselves at the highest level possible and could only generate $21 per year per capita to fund their schools. Meanwhile, the Alamo Heights district, which was predominantly white district and a wealthy district in San Antonio, taxed themselves at the lowest, near the lowest amount, and generated up to over $300 per student. Yes. Part of this is, you know, one of the myths that goes around is that people of color do not care about education for their children. If they did, they would just tax themselves. But here you have this district taxing themselves at the highest level. But because it's based on property values, which have been based on government policy, they're only able to generate $21. Per student. That case goes up to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, saying that this violates Brown. This is clearly unequal education. In a 5-4 decision, with four of those justices being appointed by Richard Nixon and one by Eisenhower, they ruled that there was no constitutional right to education and unequal funding does not violate Brown. Yes.
And that is the law of the land.
Yes. 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 And so begin to think about what that means as you have these struggling districts. And this is in the 70s, right? So you're beginning to get the era of massive white flight, where you're getting these entrenched poverty in the city, ringed by wealthy suburbs. And now you have the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, saying, that's fine. Figure out education the best you can, but you cannot use funding from another source, like from the suburbs, or to think through another way. Not quite that, but that unequal funding does not mean, and there are kids come out of poor districts who do well. So we don't believe that unequal funding actually affects the quality of schools.
Right.
Yeah. Thurgood Marshall was just apoplectic.
Now, just to be clear, that case did not hold that you could not go to a different method of funding. In other words, it didn't hold that you couldn't have all of the localities, let's say, put their money into a statewide fund and then divvy that up in an equitable fashion. It just said that you can't be compelled to do it. And of course, there's no state that's going to step in and say, oh, well, we really want to champion our poorest of districts.
Right. Exactly. You know, so one of the things that Thurgood Marshall noted as Texas was arguing that there is no correlation between school funding and a child's education, that he said, then why are all of the wealthy school districts providing amicus curiae briefs? If there's no correlation, if they're not trying to protect the inequities that they have gained by this. Why? And so it was like a 1-2 punch, because coming right on the heels of Rodriguez was the Milliken decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Again, 5-4 with Richard Nixon's and Eisenhower's justices in the majority. And Milliken dealt with Detroit, where you had a predominantly Black city, intrinsically poor, ringed by white suburbs, and as the NAACP is suing, the city tries to figure out a plan. The district court steps in and says, okay, why don't we do this by ringing in the suburbs so that we're moving black and white children from the city to the suburb and from the suburb to the city. The Supreme Court said the suburbs did not cause this problem, therefore they cannot be part of the solution. What that does then is you link Rodriguez and Milliken together, and it is a way to wall off access to resources for the poor, for poor blacks and poor people of color in general who are primarily in those cities. That's the way policy works. And so when we look at our schools, then what we say is, I mean, one of the things Lewis Powell said was, you know, it's not like back in the day. So if you can move wherever you want to move. And that doesn't take then into account the policies that have put poor people in areas where they don't have the resources to move to the suburbs. They don't have the resources to, put down 20% on a home in the burbs, or to even be able for first and last month's rent and a deposit for an apartment in a good school district. And the fact that we even have to talk about a good school district tells us that we know that there are bad school districts.
Right. Right. And we see this sort of echoed, I guess, in Reagan's funding of benefits, or I guess higher education funding. I mean, it occurs to me reading about this that there is a school of thought out there that most, I think, vocally promoted by a guy named Rick Kahlenberg. In terms of affirmative action and whatnot, that instead of using race, which is subject to a higher level of scrutiny by the courts, use geography in class and finances. So as a bank shot, and in some ways, it's sort of the reverse image, right, of what we see, where we have seen sort of consistently using the fact that African Americans will tend to be, living in poverty more often. Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Sorry.
No.
And that as a bank shot to I guess put up obstacles towards progress.
You know, I. I don't agree. it's
tell me.
Yeah, and I don't agree because it's like there's a policy here in one of the universities that tried to do that. That tried to say, okay, what we're going to do are that students who come out of the Atlanta public schools can get they have to compete, but they can get a 4-year full ride. That sounds fabulous, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And particularly when you know the school system in Atlanta is overwhelmingly black and overwhelmingly poor. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when whites figured out this, then there were certain schools that they moved to that were in the Atlanta public schools.
Hmm.
That, so then they competed for the four year full rides, and they didn't have the markers of poverty, they didn't have the markers of dealing with systemic racism, generation after generation after generation, and this is where we're in this bind, but we have had racially targeted policies. We're going to need racially targeted solutions.
That's interesting. I mean, is it the Texas case? I believe it was where they would take recently, maybe it was the Fisher case, I guess, that where they would take the top 10% from each school around the state as a way of providing some measure of distribution in terms of affirmative action. I mean, obviously, we're talking in very narrow terrain here. The gaming of the system, I guess, becomes a little bit easier, particularly, I would imagine, as you have some measure of gentrification. It sort of just increases the incentives for that on some level.
Yes. And so, that Texas case was after the Hopwood decision. Then Texas came up with its 10% plan, and I think it's now like the 7% plan, so the top 7% of each graduating class gets automatically admitted into. And you see how intense even that battle was, where Abigail Fisher, who comes out of Sugar Land, Texas, which I believe has like an average or a median income of something like $120,000, it's $107,000. And the median income for Dallas, for blacks in Dallas, is $26,000. So the disparity in access to resources is profound. And yet she's hollering, this isn't fair.
Right. Well, let's talk about that a little bit because I mean we're running a little bit late, but I want to touch on this because you also address the intense hatred directed at Barack Obama and the sort of the forces it unleashed, and you know we now have a Republican nominee who's. I mean, if you were to break it down, I would say there are two things in his biography that make it possible for him to be where he is. One, 30 years ago, he helped build an ice rink in Central Park in Manhattan with apparently what I understand now was free labor. And two, the guy was the most well-known celebrity to come out and say that there was questions as to whether or not Barack Obama was an American. And these were the two major pillars of his campaign, it seems to me. And we know that there is a significant percentage of Trump followers who, when asked the question as to whether or not society favors whether or not there is some form of racial oppression against blacks or is there racial oppression against whites, 56% said racial oppression against whites. I mean, so there's a lot of grievance here and pushback at the notion, I guess, that a black person could be president. I'm just curious as to hear your thoughts about this and specifically to the notion of anti-PC, because as we go through this historically, it seems to me there is this sort of, you know, dynamic of two steps forward, one step back, maybe two steps forward, one and three quarter steps back or whatever it is. But there is some measure of progress. And the knuckles get a little whiter, forgive the pun, as people try and hang on to at least some measure of that sort of past legacy. I'm just curious as your thoughts on that.
Yes, I mean, when I hear Make America Great Again, and there was this moment where news people were asking them, okay, so when was that? And the Trump supporters would give these dates when it, you know, oh, that was 1913, so that was before blacks and women could vote. Well, no, that's not what I meant, but that was 1913. That's when we were great. Wow. 1950, oh, that's before the Civil Rights Movement. Well, no, but yes. So what they want is an America that looks like apartheid, South Africa, apartheid South Africa. And that's where access to resources are exclusively the domain of whites, exclusively. And it's not enough. You know, there's a saying that when you've had privilege, equality looks like oppression.
Mm-hmm.
it's not enough that, you know, the recent study that came out that said it would take African Americans 248 years to equal the wealth that whites currently have.
Right.
That disparity is not enough, obviously. When Obama was elected, the birtherism mess really began to expose the ways that the, particularly the Republicans, have been trawling in the ground of racial resentment, starting with the Southern strategy under Richard Nixon, where, as Lee Atwater, who was Reagan's strategist, said, you can't use the N-word anymore. It hurts you. It backfires. So now we use, we talk about economic things like cutting taxes, or we say forced busing. But all of these things that we're talking about, the whole point is that blacks get hurt worse than whites. And it's in that framing that I also think we're seeing a lot of the resentment. So when you look at Reagan's policies, for instance, blacks got creamed. In fact, so many of the statistical markers went back to the 1960s, some back to the 1950s by the time Reagan's policies were done. But whites got hurt too, but whites then become almost the beard, the collateral damage, mm-hmm. to say, see, our policies aren't racist. Whites are getting hurt. Whites are unemployed. Whites' wages are flatlining. So these aren't racist policies. And that framing also then played to the resentment by saying the reason why whites are hurting is because, it's like Pete Wilson said, because we have to have this affirmative action in California. So when we get then to President Obama, his election just unleashed all of that vitriol and racial resentment that had been stirred and steeped and stewed since the late 1960s. The response has been, besides the hatred pouring down on this man, and I need to be really clear here, the hatred, although it's cast in terms of his policies, as they label him a socialist, this man is about as far from a socialist as you can get. Mm-hmm. It's not his policies. Yeah. It is his very being of being black that has unleashed this level of hatred. The voting suppression laws that came in the wake saying basically the only way that he was elected was through voter fraud. And if that sounds like what Donald Trump is saying right now, there's a reason why. And with that so-called voter fraud, which is not documented.
Right. We have 31 instances of voter fraud over the past, I don't know, billions of votes, literally.
Right. And, right.
I mean, it is fascinating to look at the change in the electorate in 2008 and mm-hmm. what it represents and what Barack Obama was able to do in terms of changing the Democratic coalition, and then how immediate the wow. response is to wow. begin to attack the foundations of that new coalition. You have the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. You have then literally days later the changes in North Carolina and other states that had been under the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act to immediately impose changes in their voting laws that just coincidentally disenfranchised a lot of African Americans. I mean, this is when looked through that lens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and this is, I think, the thing that I feel like I've come to understand over the past several years. This is a continuum. It is really yes. part of yes. a whole. And in some ways, that's a reason for optimism, because it moves from a solid to a liquid to a gas in some ways. And, yes. and I'm convinced, like, the anti-PC movement is the gas yes. on some level.
And I think because part of that is that when you really talk to a lot of people, the kind of vitriol that is spewing out of that says we can say whatever we want to say, really discombobulates people. They're just like, no, that there's a level of civility that we must have in an operating society. And what you're saying is unacceptable. And that is progress. It was like the in New York Times clip of the Trump rallies, where you just have this stuff spewing out of people's mouths, and they're feeling like great and empowered, but in fact, it's really this kind of cry showing how powerless they really feel, and that the only way that they can feel power is by denigrating other human beings. And there's a sense among other people that no, this is not who we are. And that is, to me, what these conversations are about right now, is this struggle to determine who we are as a nation. And I think one of the major things that we've seen is that when we, because this is a piece that I talk about in White Rage, at all of these key moments, when we go and undermine our citizens' rights, we've undermined the stability, we've undermined the viability of this nation. And when you see it when we're looking at education, you're seeing it when we're looking at mass incarceration, you're seeing it when we're looking at disfranchisement.
Well, Carol Anderson, professor at Emory of African American Studies, the book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. I really appreciate it as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, back in 1988, in the summer of 1988, as George Herbert Walker Bush, Vice President of the United States, was campaigning, talking about his introducing his grandchildren to President Reagan at a brief airport meeting. Seems a little late in the administration to be introducing them. But George Herbert Walker Bush introduced these children as, "These are Jebby's kids from Florida. The little brown ones." The little brown ones, referring, of course, to Jebby being married to a woman from Mexico. Apparently, the kids are a little brown, according to George Herbert Walker Bush. He was offended that people would argue that he had anything but pride for his little brown ones. And I'm sure that carries out in the family. Well, the little brown one is now a big brown one. And he... He is a Texas, I think, county supervisor. What is he? He's got a position in Texas. That is a pretty powerful position. I speculated at the beginning of Jeb Bush's run that this was really as much about introducing his son, George Prescott Bush, to donors around the country, with Jebby thinking, based upon the demographics of the country and the Bush name, George P. will really be the next president. I don't think that Jeb Bush could have imagined that he would leave more of a scorched earth than his brother had left. In other words, I think Jeb actually, his primary desire was to leave the Bushes in a better situation. Even if he lost in the general election, to leave them in a better situation so that George P. could run. Well, George P. realized, my dad failed me, and now I have to do this on my own.
Here he is speaking at the Texas Republican County Chairman's Association in Austin, Texas, just the other day.
And so it's a great team. When they asked me to be the victory chair this cycle, I was privileged to do so. Honored to be taking on a historic role that works to ensure that we have the resources necessary to help all of our candidates up and down the ballot. And I know that we have Trump state director here as well. And I know a lot of us in this room had jobs in the fight in the primary leading up to the race. But you know what? It's time to put it aside. And you know, from Team Bush, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but you know what? You get back up, and you help the man that won, and you make sure that we stop Hillary Clinton.
Yes, on Team Bush, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but you get back up, you help the man that won, and you make sure we stop Hillary Clinton. So in other words, Dad, I guess you're off the team. Jeb no longer on Team Bush.
Someone else is your dad now. Say hello to Daddy.
Hey, Jeb. Yeah. Hey, Jeb. Heard your boy just kicked you in the nuts. What you get,
Jeb? You are failure as man. Even son make you cock.
That's right.
Jeb is cock. Come here, give mama massage. Me no want bath rubs from you anymore, Jeb. You are so pathetic. But you will watch while mama have other man over.
No.
Oh, God.
You are cock.
Hey, Jeb, Dad called. Called you cuck.
Even little brown one don't respect you, Jeb.
Tried to tell you this would happen if you married a Mexican girl.
Brother, give you fair warning, and me mama tell you while massaging her feet in bathtub. But no, listen.
What happened to mom? She sounds like she comes from Vietnam now.
I know. What the heck?
Oh my God.
Mama, Jeff loved long time.
Yeah, just sort of like, I mean, good for Jeb. Good for Jeb. I mean, does he, I wonder if he like practices like having people kick sand in his face. I mean, I can understand. He says to his son, like, you got to do what you got to do. Jeb.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you do what you
No, I do. Instruct you to
I
do
instruct
it.
I instruct you to do it.
George P. sounds just like him too.
No, Dad, I don't want to do it. You will do it. It's the only way.
It's the Bush way.
He made a lady of me, and he'll make a lady of you too. It's okay.
Mission accomplished.
Oh my God. Oh, Jeb.
Jeb just not a terrible enough person to be successful in this cycle.
George is the Texas State Land Commissioner.
He's the Texas State, which is apparently a powerful position down there.
Probably a nice little place to give land away to corporations and to spoil the environment.
I got to say that I don't know if there's enough time. I mean, he'll go and he'll run for Senate or for the governorship. And he'll serve for, you know, so he's probably thinking now, let's see, 8 years takes us to 2024. I bet this guy is thinking 2032. And I promise you, my children will be working against him.